Okay, thank you for joining us for this next session. I'd like to thank Professor Kenneth Ehrenberg for his most fascinating talk. We're ready to proceed with the next talk by Dr. Naftali Lowenthal, who is a lecturer on Jewish spirituality at University College London, one of the key authorities on Hasidic philosophy, and he published the work Communicating the Infinite, published by University of Chicago Press, which is one of the principal works on Chabad Hasidic philosophy, the emergence of the Chabad school. The title of his talk this afternoon is Breaking the Barrier Between Tradition and Modernity, the Life and Teachings of Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er Schneerson, who was born in 1860 and passed away in 1920. Therefore, this year is 90 years since his passing, and as one of the most important figures in the development of Chabad philosophy, mysticism, it's a great pleasure to dedicate this seminar to his life and his work, and most appropriate to have a talk on the subject by Dr. Lowenthal. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. It's 90 years since his passing, and it's 150 years since he was born. And in fact, that 150th anniversary was just a few days ago, the exact day that he was born. So we do tend to go for, in fact, there's a psychological phenomenon, the anniversary. The anniversary. So we do tend to say, well, it's the 150th anniversary, the 100th anniversary, the 200th, the centenary, bicentenary. So therefore, this gives an opportunity to talk about Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er Schneerson. Now, breaking the barrier between tradition and modernity, I'm not going to try to do anything terribly clever about that title, which I gave Ellie. Ellie said, you know, you must have a title. Because simply, in the face of the secularization that was taking place during the 19th century for the Jewish community as a whole in Europe, in Western Europe, from the middle of the 18th century, there had been the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. And this Central European Enlightenment, begun or fathered by Moses Mendelssohn, as we normally see it, began seeping into Eastern Europe as well. And this was a gradual process taking place from the beginning of the 19th century and then with increasing increasing its velocity and its effect on communities. And so living and active from as Hasidic leader in the latter part, the late part of the 19th century, Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er, a Hasidic Rebbe, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, was basically trying to draw or drag traditional Jewish spirituality, as he understood it, into the modern world. And it's in that sense that he was breaking the barrier between tradition and modernity, because you could say that we are now in a modern world. Tradition is something of the past, yes, but we are new people and we're living under new conditions. So forget about the past, that's old-fashioned. And Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er was trying to somehow do the opposite. Now Eli, whose name is Dov Be'er, has pointed out that I misspelt the name, and it should be D-O-V-B-E-R. So please excuse me in the rush to get this brief little PowerPoint organized. Thank you very much for setting it up. But Yisrael is, Dr. Sandman is going to be using it as well. So that sort of justifies it. Now, how long is this bit of the...
40 minutes.
Okay. Now... Rabbi Shalom Dov Be'er, first of all, I did have a student who wrote a PhD about him at UCL, called Rabbi Dr. Naftali Brauer. Rabbi Dr. Brower is a rabbi in a United Synagogue in London, and he's part of the chief rabbi's cabinet. I think his special responsibility now is Islam. However, he wrote a PhD on this figure, and some of what I'm going to say today is using material from his PhD. It's an unpublished PhD. He did publish one article that I know of, translated into Hebrew, on a certain aspect of Rabbi Sholem Dovber's work. Otherwise, I do not know of any academic studies on him as yet. Now, what Brower actually focused on was the activity of Rav Sholem Dovber as a Hasidic Rebbe. Now, a Hasidic Rebbe is, at that stage of the development of Hasidism, it was basically a dynastic position, usually, not always. And his father had been Rebbe before him, Rav Shmuel, and when his father passed away in 1882, in the autumn, Rav Sholem Dovber became Rebbe at the tender age of 22. He had an older brother, and a Rebbe, Hasidic Rebbe, is expected to be everything for his community. He's expected to be able to give advice about business matters, about personal issues, and in Chabad in particular, he is expected to teach Torah in a particular way, which I will try to explain. So for a while, for about 10 years, Rav Sholem Dovber and his brother shared the rabbistva, the position of Rebbe, with his brother giving business advice, and Rabbi Sholem Dovber just taught spiritual teachings. However, eventually he became the only Rebbe and was a very forceful and powerful figure. And what Brower focuses on his PhD is in three parts. One is his battle concerning the Russian Haskalah movement, that means the Enlightenment movement, which was addressed to the Jewish community and was trying to, we would say, or one could say, secularize the Jewish community. And it was an organization called the Chevra Mefitzei Haskalah, the Society for the Spread of the Haskalah. They set up schools all over Russia. They were very successful. And they were getting funding from other, from outside Russia as well. And Rabbi Sholem Dovber saw them as a serious threat to Judaism, to the survival of Judaism. There is a sense in which the secularization of Jewish life in Russia was leading to the Jewish membership of the Communist Party and later the Yesvektsia, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, determined to eradicate Judaism from Russia. And so therefore any kind of Jewish education was banned and people who were trying to give it were arrested. That was after the death of Rabbi Sholem Dovber. But he, 25 years earlier, is battling against what could be seen as a stage in the development of this fiercely anti-traditional form of Jewish identity, which was trying to destroy the concept of Judaism for the Jews. He was also, a second part of Brower's thesis was about his criticism of Zionism, which at that point he saw as a secularizing force. When Orthodox Jews in 1892 published a book called Shivat Zion, popularizing return to Zion, popularizing the idea of returning to Israel, it contained dozens of letters from Orthodox rabbis encouraging settling in the land of Israel, linked with the generally Orthodox Chibat Zion movement, which had founded Rishon LeZion, The Rabbi Shalom Dover, generally called the Rashab by his initial letters, Reish, Shein, and then the B of Dover. So the Rashab did not in any way complain. He didn't say anything negative to that. And that was an Orthodox Zionist thrust. But in 1897, there was the first Zionist Congress. And in the spring of 1899, a very forceful Zionist called Max Mandelstam published an open letter in the Hebrew journal Hamelitz, in which he said, one who is not a Zionist is not a Jew, even if he learns Torah and keeps mitzvot. So this was a kind of challenge to the whole concept of being of Judaism and of the role of traditional Judaism. Of course, there was a view, a Zionist view, that traditional Judaism only existed in order to preserve the Jews until they would then go back to the land of Israel, and they didn't actually need the mitzvot. And so at this period of time, as early Zionist groups were actually strongly secular, and so the Rashab worked against them, and there was a book, Ol Yesharim, published in 1900, where there was articles by him, by Reb Chaim of Brisk, Rabbi Soloveitchik, by the British chief rabbi Herman Adler, and various other rabbis, all against the secular Zionist view, which he was worried that secular Zionism would replace Judaism. Now, and as he said, as he put it, while a person following the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, the secular Enlightenment, knew that he departed from the Torah, the secular Zionist thought that he was fulfilling the Torah. Now, this was his attitude then, and then we have the whole process after his passing of the Zionist movement, leading ultimately to the founding of the State of Israel. And it's very interesting that the position of the later Lubavitcher Rebbe, his own son, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, when it was the War of Independence in Israel, although his father had been so fiercely against Zionism, he said, we have to support the War of Independence. And later on, his successor, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1994, was strongly pro-Israel in many senses and refused to accept the idea of chiloniut, of chiloni, the idea of anyone being secular in Israel. Someone wrote him in a recently published letter, which he wrote in 1975, someone referred to a school as being chiloni, an Israeli school. And the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's two Rebbeim Om from Rabbi Shalom Dovber, said, what do you mean chiloni? These are Jews who are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You cannot call anything concerning them chiloni in any way. So that's a sort of aspect of, at the same time, he was very concerned for the separation of church and state within the Israeli context, and very much wanted that Israel should consciously represent Jewish values. Anyway, so these are two sections of Braver's thesis. The third section of his thesis is the area that I'm going to focus on, and that is the founding of Tomchei Tmimim. The founding of Tomchei Tmimim is the Lubavitch Yeshiva system, which was founded in 1897. Rabbi Shalom Dovber had wanted to found this yeshiva for 10 years, he said, from 1887. He'd been thinking about it, but he was not able to until 10 years later. And according to Brava, he needed someone who would be able to run the yeshiva. And it was his own son, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, his only son, who at the age of 17 was now married and was deemed to be in a position that he could actually run the yeshiva. And then Rabbi Shalom Dovber felt that this is the time to move in and create this. Now, the question is, what was so significant about founding a yeshiva? Surely there are yeshivot all over the world. So what is special about this? Well, the idea of a yeshiva, actually, I'm not quite sure exactly the genealogy of the modern concept of yeshiva. The first modern kind of yeshiva was founded by Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, in Volozhin, in 1802, I think it was. And the yeshiva, really, the new thing about the Volozhin yeshiva is that it was like a boarding school. Now, I'm not quite sure. Professor Shaul Stamfer has written a book about the emergence of the Lithuanian yeshiva. And I'm not sure whether he discusses the kind of, what kind of analogy they were using in order to create these yeshivot, but it might come back, as so many things at this period do come back, to England, to the boarding school, Eton, Winchester, the whole idea of a school where people are there with a dormitory, a kitchen, and a structure, and they're being looked after, the members of this educational establishment. All throughout the centuries, there were yeshivot of different kinds, but they were simply, in a very haphazard way, if we were talking about the poor who were attending, and anyone who didn't have someone in the town where they could be housed, they would come to a Beis Medrash, they would, Beit HaMedrash, they would study with a famous scholar, but to, at this period, certainly after the, in a period of general decline, after the decline of the Council of the Four Lands and other reasons, there's the concept of essenteg, which people might have heard of, eating days, that the student would sleep in the study house, and in order to eat, he would go to different householders, one per day. So Sunday was this householder, Monday another, and in that way the student would be fed. And of course he was always the sort of the, in a sense, the unwanted guest at the table. Whereas Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin said, no, we can't do this. Torah has to be honored, covered HaTorah, and the glory of Torah, the honor of Torah, and therefore he set up a structure where a student in the yeshiva was able to feel that he was a mensch, that he had somewhere to sleep, a clean bed, someone to do the laundry, and food was available. Now, the Hasidic movement was very unsure about how to greet this phenomenon, and it was actually taking a plunge on the part of Rabbi Shalom Dovber. He finally decided he would set up the first Hasidic yeshiva. However, it had a major difference, which made it very different from the Volozhin yeshiva. Although Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin wrote a book called Nefesh HaChaim, which is an interpretation of Kabbalistic thought, and there is within the Mitnagdic stream a tradition of Kabbalistic study, it was not regarded as something that should be part of the normative yeshiva, and the students who come to the yeshiva were expected to study exactly what Professor Ehrenberg described before, the Talmud, and to some extent the halakha and the decisions of the Talmud, very often close, deep analysis of the reasons within the Talmud itself, but not the mystical dimension. There had been an attempt to run a yeshiva in the 18th century in Italy by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, a great sage, who very widely regarded, especially in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, for his book Mesilat Yesharim, The Path of the Just, and he also wrote a number of Kabbalistic books, 138 Entrances to Wisdom, and he tried to set up a yeshiva in which the students studied Kabbalah. When one of these students wrote a letter, an excited letter home, or not home, he wrote an excited letter to a friend of his, saying, wow, this yeshiva is really great, we learn Zohar all night. And somehow his friend's parents intercepted this letter and got a terrible shock. Living somewhere in Italy, they showed it to a rabbi. The rabbi took it to the Bet Din. The Bet Din said, you've got to stop this practice. You can't teach Kabbalah to these young men. It's unhealthy. And so that had to stop. However, that was in 1700 and something. However, in 1897, under the threat of modernity, Rabbi Shalom Dovber, the Rashab, set up a yeshiva where an important part of the curriculum was studying the Kabbalistic mystical dimension, termed Hasidut, Hasidic teachings, and that was presenting another side to the whole project of studying Talmud. As he put it in a letter which he wrote about the founding of the yeshiva, many of the rabbis, at that time you had institutionalized rabbis who were government-sponsored, Rabbanim Mitam HaMemshala, rabbis who were approved by the government and they had been to some kind of modernizing seminary, rabbinic seminary. So Rabbi Sholem Dovber, he said, these rabbis Mitam, what do? They do not support the details of Judaism, they laugh, they mock many aspects of Jewish thought. This yeshiva is going to be producing people who have a spiritual quality, who have fear of God, and who engage in spiritual prayer in different ways. In fact, as Brava notes, a very important element in this yeshiva is not just the Rosh Yeshiva, who is the Talmudic expert, but the Mashpia, the spiritual guide. And the spiritual guide was a person with great spiritual sensitivity and awareness. A beautiful book about them is about such a figure is a memoir by Rabbi Nochum Shemaria Sosonkin, who was a student in the yeshiva set up by Rabbi Shalom Dovber. He was a student in 1906. And he describes the relationship with the mashpiim, these spiritual guides. One of them was called Gronem, Rabbi Gronem Osterman. Another one was called Rabbi Michoel Blinner the Elder, Rabbi Michoel the Old. And he describes what it was like being in a Hasidic gathering where there would be a little bit of vodka would be drunk, they would be singing melodies, and with great tenderness and love, the teacher would be communicating with them, inspiring them to dedicate their lives to Jewish teaching, to the tradition of Judaism, and to the depths of Torah. Now, Rabbi Shalom Dovber actually wrote a tract. He didn't write a tract. I'm going to start with something he didn't write, but he told his son. I mentioned his son, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, was the person who was running this yeshiva. Now, the yeshiva was in different towns. One of the towns was in Lubavitch, and this is an artist's impression of Lubavitch around 1900, and the sort of heavier area that you can see over here, that is where the Rebbe's Hof was. That's like a kind of an area where you've got the Rebbe's synagogue and the houses where the Rebbe lived, and that's where the yeshiva was. More recently, this is a photo I took in Lubavitch in 1991, and I don't think it's changed very much over the last 100 years. And in fact, an aspect of the Rebbe, of Rabbi Shalom Dovber, I'm just digressing slightly because I remember I've got this slide. Rabbi Shalom Dovber did give advice. I mentioned that there was a time when he only taught Torah, the spiritual dimension of Torah for the most part. But although he also taught things about the Talmud as well. But there was a point when he did take on his shoulders the mantle of giving advice. And when I visited Lubavitch in 1991, I met this old lady, and the young man on the left was a person who could speak Russian and was translating. Now, this lady told me that her father was a wealthy, or grandfather, her grandfather was a wealthy farmer. And he had known the Rebbe, who was there in Lubavitch. There was only one Rebbe in Lubavitch in the 20th century. And the Rebbe would give him advice about his farm. Now, her father was not Jewish, her grandfather. And she said the Rebbe would sit by the window in his shul, which incidentally, I don't know if you can see, but just behind it there was actually a church. So in terms of the geography of this little shtetl, you've got the two religious organizations next to each other. So her father or grandfather would come to the Rebbe. The Rebbe would sit in the window and her grandfather would stand outside asking questions, and the Rebbe would give advice. And she said with a smile, her grandfather did very well. He was a very successful businessman, with the idea that somehow implying that it was the Rebbe who was giving advice to this. To him in order to be successful in this way. However, we're now going back to the students who are there in this yeshiva. And there is the mashpia who is guiding them. What is he guiding them? He's guiding them towards mystical prayer. That's one of the key attainments that came out of this system of Tomchei Tmimim, this special new kind of yeshiva. And it is, and Rav Shalom Dovber, I mean, first of all, there's the whole idea of Hasidic teaching. Hasidic teaching comes from the Kabbalah. In the middle of the 18th century, the founder of Hasidism, Rabbi Yisrael Bar Shem Tov, wrote a letter where he described a mystical experience which expressed the idea that the communication of Hasidic teaching, his take, his particular brand of teaching the inner dimension of Torah. The Zohar talks about the garments of the Torah, which are the stories, the guf of the Torah, the body of the Torah, which is like the halakha, the laws, and then there's the neshama, the soul of the Torah, and even the soul of the soul, like deeper levels of soul. So here we have, they have a yeshiva where they're studying the Talmud, and that is that's the body of the Torah. Rabbi Shalom Dovber did have very specific ideas about how you study Talmud as well. And he believed that the Talmudic discussion can be read back into the details of the Mishnah. Now, that's an interesting concept, because normally we see the oral Torah as a kind of a fluid expression of the details of the biblical text. But he was moving the Midrashic process further. The Midrashic process takes the details of the biblical text and expounds it. So why is there an extra vav in this word? Why is this expression repeated? It must have some meaning. And so the Talmudic or Midrashic authorities will discuss that and elucidate a view, whether in Agadah, whether in the story part of the tradition, or in the halachic part of the tradition. But what Reb Shalom Dovber recommended in his book, Tract on the Tree of Life, Kuntres Eitz HaChaim, I'm speaking of a number of tracts which were all written around 1900, in this, he spoke about the way in which the halachic part of the discussion in the Talmud, which is a halachic discussion, but it's a discussion of the Mishnah, could be and should be read back into the details of the Mishnah, so that the Mishnah itself is seen as the repository of that whole Talmudic theme. It's an interesting idea which could possibly be linked with the ideas of the Maharal of Prague and his student, the Tosfot Yom Tov, Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller, about the role of Mishnah in Talmudic discussion. And the Tosfot Yom Tov, the commentary on the Mishnah written by Rabbi Heller, the disciple of the Maharal, is in fact a advanced Talmudic discussion, but focused around the Mishnah. Although not necessarily following that page of Talmud, it could be anywhere in the Talmud. So that's something about Rabbi Shalom Dovber's discourse or speaking about the study of Talmud. But then comes his Hasidic teachings. So the Hasidic teachings, one aspect is what he writes in Tract on Prayer, which is a critique. It is a way of applying a critique to the way in which a person engages in contemplation and what sort of ideas they have in their mind when they contemplate. Now, a very simple form of contemplation, which is part of the Chabad arsenal, which is written in Tanya, printed in 1796, is the idea of the upper unity and the lower unity. The upper unity is associated with Shema Yisrael, the first line of the Shema, Hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And that's called the Yichuda Ila'a, the upper unity, which means that there is only the divine. The person comes to a kind of a mystical way of seeing, which is called a cosmist by people like Professor Rachel Elior, writing about the paradoxical ascent to God in Chabad, her description of early Chabad thought. So it's this cosmist view that there is only God, Ein od milvado, there is nothing apart from the divine. And so while the person has their hands over their eyes saying the Shema, they are lost in God, in that sense, as Gershon Scholem put it. And then you have another perspective, which complements that and contrasts with it, is the Yichuda Tata'a, the lower unity, which is what happens with the Baruch Shem when we say the second line of the Shema, which is explained as another way of saying that God is one, but in a hidden way. And it's said in a whisper, because one is then recognizing that in the world around us, God is there in every aspect of existence. And so when a person thinks in this way and starts applying this, and Rav Shalom Dovber wrote tracts where you can take this to the nth degree of thinking about it in all kinds of different ways and applying it, that is a way one gets into modes, different modes of deep contemplative prayer. Now, this painting by Zalman Kleiman, painted in the 1970s, a Chabad artist, called Shabbos Afternoon, it illustrates, it depicts a synagogue in Crown Heights in New York. But it illustrates people who are praying and contemplating using techniques which Reb Shalom Dovber communicated and taught. And you have particularly this person who is immobile. He seems to be following a very deep system of meditation. I know one person today who follows this same system, and he uses Rabbi Shalom Dovber's material in order to meditate. And a person who is in this kind of state might be totally inert to the world. You call them, they don't hear, or they're as if 1,000 miles away. And because he is in this tremendous realm that Reb Shalom Dovber revealed in his teachings. Now, I'd like to try, if we look at where it says chapter 5, let's try to look at this aspect of what Reb Shalom Dovber says about the Talmudist. Would you like to read this? The Talmudist studies Torah? No.
My husband, let him read.
Okay.
I can read one in public.
Okay.
The Talmudist studies Torah profoundly, examining each halakha in all its details systematically, thoroughly mastering the differing opinions of the commentators, creating novella with rigorous reasoning. Similarly, one may engage in the service of the heart with prolonged meditation during worship on the subjects of the inner Torah in the study. The subject penetrates deep within him. He feels it and assimilates it. Through this sensitivity and assimilation, the subject achieves dvekus in his mind and he becomes attached to the subject.
Right, now dvekus means cleaving and bonding. So he's describing whether one is studying the revealed Torah or the inner Torah, it penetrates deep within him. This is from one of Rabbi Shalom Dovber's tracts. And we then see this sense of dveikut, this sense of unity with the subject. David, would you like to read? There are two methods.
There are two methods of profound study of concepts. One may study some specific subject, whether in revealed Torah or in the inner Torah, immersing himself in his study. Intellectual immersion is identical with dveikus, for while immersed, he is united and attached to the concept he is examining. This is true only for the time he is engaged in this profound study. But when he has learned it well and understood it properly and has turned to some other subject, then the depths he had reached earlier are forgotten.
Right, so in other words, there's something very beautiful and luminous while one is actually studying. It might be Talmud, it might be a mystical tract. But when one turns to something else, the light goes off and you're involved in something else. This is what he wanted to try to combat. Would you like to go on the other method?
I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay. Would you like? The other method, the bottom line, 79.
The other method of profound study is to achieve assimilation of the concept. Then the dveikus is like that of the first insight, constantly brilliant. Attaining this is a formidable aspect of the service of the heart in prolonged contemplation during worship.
In other words, he's trying to attain, to teach the attaining of a state where the light remains on. There's some kind of inner illumination which is revealed through this study of Torah, so that the Or HaTorah, the radiance of the Torah, continues to shine. Here we see these people in the act of prayer or contemplation before prayer, because this is a picture of a synagogue in the afternoon. There was a Shabbat morning service. They read the Torah, it was crowded with people. Now most of the people have gone home and there's this small group left. And these contemplatives, watched by the little boy who represents the painter himself, this group of contemplatives, they are the ones who are focusing on this sort of radiance from the Torah that they have studied, which is going to carry them into the prayer that they are going to take part in. Now, Rabbi Shalom Dovber wrote some very lengthy philosophical tracts of Hasidic philosophy, hundreds of pages long. Now, if you've written a tract of Hasidic philosophy, you might think, well, it would be a good idea to communicate this to people and let them have the book and they'll read it, and maybe someone will they write a review of it, or what will they do? Within the context of the Hasidic community, when a Rebbe writes a book of this kind, he has another strategy how to communicate it in a completely different way. What Rabbi Shalom Dovber did, he took his book, this long book, and he divided it up into little groups of like 5 pages at a time. 5 pages he's going to say at a Hasidic gathering on Friday night, when all the Hasidim will be there and they will be singing beautiful melodies in order to get into the mood to hear this mystic teaching from the Rebbe. And then the Rebbe comes into the room and everyone goes silent immediately, and they hear him begin to teach something about the Sedra of the week. Let's say it's Shabbat Bereshit, the Shabbat of the first section of the Torah, Bereshit. And he asks a question about Bereshit. And then he says, in order to understand that, and now he launches in to this long philosophical discussion, which is 5 pages of a 300-page tract. And at the end of the 5 pages, he somehow ties that in to an answer to the question he asked about Bereshit. So that was the Hasidus, the Hasidic teaching on Bereshit. The next week, it's Shabbat Parshat Noach. Then, comes another question. Again, the Hasidim are gathered there on a Friday night. There's a beautiful melody being sung. The Rebbe comes in. Everyone falls silent. A hushed silence. What is he going to say? He starts off with a question about Sedra Noah, the next Sedra in Genesis. And he says, in order to understand that, and he goes on with the next 5 pages of his discourse, and then he concludes that as well with an answer to that question, and so it goes on week after week after week. And the students who hear this, they learnt it by heart. They were able, from hearing it once, they were able to say it by heart. Now, I did not speak to any of his followers, but I spoke to followers of the next Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, who was in Otwock in Warsaw. And I spoke to one of his followers when I was researching a paper about the Lubavitch Yeshiva system. And he told me that you would come on also on a Friday night to hear the Rebbe's mimer, his discourse, and the next day you were expected to be able to say the whole thing by heart to a group of people. If you couldn't say it by heart after hearing it once, you would not be allowed to be part of the group next week who hears it. Only 10 boys were able to hear it. The others were the old Hasidim. So these boys were selected by their powers of being able to be so focused on what the Rebbe was saying, they could remember the whole thing. An extremely subtle discussion. Now, I have a friend, David Solomon. He is, at some point, one of the things he wants to do is write a translation and presentation of one of Rabbi Sholem Dovber's books. And this is what he, in discussion, you know, what does this book actually say? And he says like this: it focuses on the Lurianic writings and early Chabad texts in order to present a strikingly clear account of the paradox of man, who has one foot in the physical world and the other, so to speak, in the realms beyond the world. It emphasizes that Torah and Mitzvot are crucial as the fulcrum of existence. The philosophy of this work, which is the teachings of 1906, Tafleish Samachvav, emphasized the importance of language, which provides a continuum reaching from the infinite beyond to the material world and back, permeated with prayer, Torah study, and melody, which is beyond language. Now, we've come to the end of our time, and these teachings were understood by the people at the time and by later generations as having incredible sanctity. And by a generation or generations of yeshiva students absorbing these teachings, trying to see within them what is the meaning, what is the bechein, what is the effect of this teaching in one's personal daily life, that created a most powerful force, which David Fishman has discussed in an article called Preserving Tradition in the Land of Revolution, where he speaks about Reb Shalom Dovber's students a generation later, who are now the rabbis in the 1920s in Russia, in the USSR, risking their lives and sometimes giving up their lives in order to preserve Judaism, traditional Judaism, in a world where the Yesvektia, the Jewish Communist Party, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, wants to eradicate Jewish practice. Now, Rabbi Shalom Dovber had passed away. It was his son, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, who was now the Rebbe, who was running this. But that quality is the inheritance which comes from these books of Hasidic teachings. And I'll just finally end with one point. He defined the concept of a pnimi, an inward person. There's a chitzen, an external kind of person, a superficial kind of person. A pnimi is an inward person. What is an inward person? Bechlal is dos ayika godl. It's a great general principle. As vozmi is, zoma zayn mita emes. What one is, one should be genuinely. Whatever one is doing at that moment, the entire person should be doing it. Whatever one is, that's what one should be totally. you can then jump from one thing to another. But while you are doing that and being that, that's what you are. And this quality is what he tried to transmit to his students through the generations. So, thank you. That is the song.
Into the next session.
Okay.
That's okay. Or do you want to take some questions?
I don't mind. It's your time.
We'll take one question, 2 minute break, in the next session. Go ahead, David.
Mysticism is usually defined as the attempt by an individual to rise to knowledge or union with God by various means, which can be chants, texts, music, dance, and so on. And in religions such as Roman Catholicism, where there is a well-defined religious hierarchy, mysticism, this attempt by an individual, has been seen as bypassing the chain of authority, because there the priest is an intermediary between individuals and God. Now, in Judaism, there isn't the priest is rarely functioning, the rabbi is rarely functioning as an intermediary, and the hierarchy isn't so well defined. Would it be true to say that in Judaism there has been little or no criticism of mysticism for that reason? It's regarded as legitimate and not illegitimate.
Well, that's an interesting suggestion, David, and it might explain why there was criticism of the Hasidic movement. Because the Hasidic movement at its inception said things like, the boy who blows on his tin whistle in the synagogue is closer to God than the rabbi. You know, so there was a hierarchical aspect to the rabbinate, and the way that the rabbinate in the 18th and 19th century saw itself in relation to the community. And this this kind of statement, which ascribed great spirituality to the simple man, which we find in Sholem Dovber's writings, including what I've given out to you, that did upset people. And what he tried to do was to teach Torah in such a way that it inculcates humility at the same time. And it's that aspect of humility which is the real hallmark of this approach to Hasidic and mystical thought. And any kind of Torah study could lead to a hierarchical division. That's the process of knowledge. Knowledge can lead people into an ivory tower, and that can be linked with authority, communal authority, in very tangible economic terms.
And the idea of intermediary between individuals and God.
Well, the point is that according to a Hasidic thought, every individual Jew has a spark of the divine within them. So the role of any rabbi is seen as the one who can illuminate that spark within the individual so that each person finds the godliness within themselves.
Okay. Thank you.